On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right, let's get a brand new, fresh, shiny week started. What do you say, shall we? About a minute and a half past the hour. This Monday evening edition of Head On is happening. I'm Bob. And I'm sure somebody will have something else, nothing particularly earth-shattering going down today, as far as I can see. Phil Spector was convicted of second-degree murder. Look, you take that hair in front of a jury, it's good for stream littering by itself. Just is, but it, so there's some other things to talk about. Sports fans out there, especially those of a certain age. By a certain age, I mean my age and older. Well, you cherish a really, really good sports broadcaster. And being a broadcaster at all, folks like Red Barber, Harry Carey, and a number of others, too many to mention, redefined for generations what communication meant. And we lost another giant today. Phillies broadcaster Harry Callis passed away, 73 years old. But instead of some sort of situation where the news story would say, he died after a long illness surrounded by his family. No, Harry Callis lived to see his beloved Phils take the World Series last year. He threw out the first pitch before the Phils faced the Braves on April the 8th, and he was at work today. 73 years old. In the press box at National Stadium in D.C. about 12:30 when he collapsed. He died at work. Philadelphia fans are in mourning. People who respect broadcasting and see, for me, the baseball broadcaster probably has the hardest job because of the nature of the game. I know there's a lot of people out there that don't even like baseball. I'm not one of them. I love baseball. And a baseball broadcaster has to be so much more than just a sports nut. From Red Barber to Vin Scully with the Dodgers, They have to be able to, well, look, I hate 4 unfilled minutes in the 3 hours I do a night. By virtue of the fact that there is no clock on a baseball game, baseball, well, as George Carlin noted, can go on forever. There's no sudden death. Although I guess extra innings would qualify, whoever has the lead after the end of an extra inning, but you know what I mean. A rain delay? To sit there and talk baseball through a rain delay in a game, in a season that is 162 games long? Baseball broadcasters, both the play-by-play and the color guys, have a job like none other. And if you can call 9 innings of baseball on the radio, there's not much on planet Earth that you are not qualified to talk about. And Harry Callis did that for a lot of years. The mayor of Philadelphia said it was a very sad day for Philadelphia and the region. He said the absolute one constant with the Phillies was Harry Callis. So, condolences to his family. Condolences to Phil's fans. And broadcasting in general has lost another great one. Because I'm a little bit of a geek. And I don't think there are that many out there. Because television changed. For the worse. Television changed baseball announcing. Radio, and you know because you tune into this program and perhaps others, is something that happens via the ears exclusively in the mind. You have to work harder with radio than you do with television, where everything is spoon-fed you, where there is a whole panoply of imagery and sound and manipulation of the imagery and close-ups and wide shots, all to keep your mind suspended in a sort of nether region of information transmission. If, on the other hand, someone who is speaking only to your auditory sense tells you about the green of the outfield grass, simply saying the outfield grass is green is not enough. It doesn't make it live. On the other hand, however, a great broadcaster, be it news or sports, can conjure images in your mind that may not even remotely resemble what he or she is looking at, but which will suffice to help you build an image around which that broadcaster can then weave his or her details into a cohesive narrative. And that's the magic. Often it is the case that sons follow fathers in that business. Skip Carey followed Harry. And Skip has a son, Chip, who followed Skip. So too with Harry Callis. Harry has a son, Todd, And Todd is the play-by-play guy for the Tampa Bay. No longer Devil Rays. Too many fundamentalists in Florida. They're just Rays. Maybe they're little rays of sunshine. Tampa Bay Rays. Condolences to Todd. It must be a special thing for a father to see his son follow him into his business, whether his business is tool and die, auto mechanic, or broadcaster. I have no doubt that Harry Callis did well by Todd. Todd's gone pro. They don't just put the son in there because of the name. There's a learning curve. So, a note on the passing, then, of Harry Callis, and wherever the flickering candle flame goes when it goes out, so too our thoughts follow Harry Callis, the people he touched, and those who loved him. We lost another one. So, so that's that. But you know what? There's more than just maybe there's a little broadcast frame cooking here this evening. Something from over at Salon. An opinion page by Camille Paglia. I don't think you pronounce the G. I think it's one of those silent Italian G's, Paglia. Pagliacci, you know, you don't pronounce the G. Paglia. Now, do you? I don't think so. Someone writes in to her to make inquiry about liberal radio. And, of course, this is a topic upon which I can wax philosophic nigh endlessly. If you look up Camille Paglia's opinion page at Salon, it's under the opinion section at salon.com. You'll find this. Someone writes in saying that liberal talkers' jokes are mean-spirited. The person writing to her wonders why programs with a liberal bent have fared so poorly in the free market. Well, first of all, the question frames the issue in a way that is not unfair, but dishonest. I'm not saying the question, I'm not saying the querier is dishonest, but the question is. I, too, have wondered why programs of the liberal bent have fared so poorly in the free market. Well, first of all, the market is not free. The market where liberal talk is concerned on terrestrial radio is anything but free. It is a captive market. It is a captive market owned by the right wing, purveyors of broadcast have to struggle to get programming on the air. The biggest purveyor of broadcast media that is liberal on the radio, where I think personally commentary is better than television commentary, then again, you know, hear the previous. Dial Media, which I guess used to be Jones, and now has Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, and that burgeoning, ballooning TV star, Ed Schultz. You know, he's twice the man I'll ever be. They have to struggle. And they have some money behind them, but they have to struggle to get liberals on radio stations across the country. And a lot of that doesn't have a damn thing to do with the quality of the programming. It has everything to do with the ideology of the license, the license holders for the individual broadcast frequencies. So when the owners of broadcast operations refuse to put liberals on the air, it has not a damn thing to do with a free market. It is, as I have asserted, a captive market. It is a matter of fighting uphill with one foot in a bucket. So this person writes to Camille Paglia and says and asks a question and then answers it for himself, saying that people who listen to talk radio are largely either in their car or at home, and that the demographics for both audiences therefore skew rightward. These groups would also tend to be much more likely to listen to Laura Schlesinger than Al Franken, he asserts. Something about that doesn't ring true. Secondly, this person asserts, liberal talk shows I've listened to are not really all that entertaining. And this is the important part. The jokes tend to be mean-spirited and personal attacks and are rarely as clever as what I've heard on Rush Limbaugh's program. Wow. The jokes tend to be mean-spirited and personal attacks and are rarely as clever as what I have heard on Rush Limbaugh's program. Clever. Clever. You know, a rat that can get through the maze fastest is clever. Barack the Magic Negro is clever. I hope he fails is clever. I can pull up a list of the rotten, tawdry, mean-spirited, vile, hateful things that Uncle Rusty Flimball has cranked out over the years, over the months, over the weeks, you know, day before yesterday. Yes, today! And that's clever? As compared to what? And then the writer to Camille Paglia says, I think if the left wants to have a successful talk radio platform, they should be asking people like Jon Stewart for ideas and quit trying to silence the opposition. I don't think that's thinking. I think that's believing. Jon Stewart, again, and no detraction from him, has at his beck and call a vast array of visual stimuli upon which to build. He mugs. Gloriously, he mugs. I love to watch Jon Stewart work his face. It's adorable, and it's funny as hell. But you can't mug on the radio. If it can't be done with a voice or a sound effect or a noise, it doesn't happen on the radio. And moreover, it's not the opposition who's being silenced. We're the ones who are silenced. Now, I say we rather broadly and inclusively because I am not a terrestrial broadcaster. I am not, as you know, dependent upon anyone but you, the people who choose to share your time and listen to this program for this program's continued existence. Even given the kindness of Coal River Mountain Watch in sponsoring shows on this network, if you weren't listening, there'd be no point. This is literally point-to-point broadcasting, with no commercial intermediary. We are not, as I've described the process before, we are not delivering potential purchasers to potential sellers, which is the model in commercial terrestrial broadcasting. We are not selling you gold bond medicated powder, whatever the hell that stuff is. Oh, Bob, it's great. I tried it. I just don't know. I'm not criticizing it. We're just not selling it to you. We don't have Preparation H in creams and suppositories. We do not have lanacane ointment. Nor the usual raft of other garbage that's hustled, or maybe not garbage. I don't know. Maybe those herbal erection pills that just turn you into a priapic monolith that sends ladies screaming from the room. But whatever it is, we ain't that. So when we talk about commercial models, we are obviously not talking about what we do here. I came up with a phrase for it the other day. I call it the luxury of poverty, which I worried about a little bit after I had said it the other night because it felt rather demeaning, not to me, but to people who deal with grinding poverty, who I am sure would take me out behind the woodshed and be more than happy to explain to me that there ain't no luxury in it. It was a statement I used, ironically, along the lines of freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. But be that as it may, now that's all set up. Camille Paglia's answer is interesting as well. She says, and I wonder how much of it she's listened to. I don't know. That is simply me. What I do not know. But she makes an assertion about liberal radio, and it is this: liberal hosts like to snap and snip and chortle snidely, but they are weighed down by a complacent superiority complex, a paralyzing sanctimony. Sanctimony? I don't know. They mistake irony for wit. The conservative hosts love to rant and stomp and bring down the house. They're doing breakneck vaudeville. Will anybody familiar with the history of vaudeville just shoot me a note and tell me if breakneck vaudeville is a subdomain or subcategory or subspecies of vaudeville? I mean, I know slapstick came from literally the slapstick. Breakneck vaudeville, is this a real term, or is this art within the terms of the creation of this column on which we are focusing? They're doing breakneck vaudeville while liberal hosts are primly stirring their non-caffeine green tea. You know, I've thought a lot of things about Ed Schultz, but one of the things I've never thought about Ed Schultz was an image of him primly doing anything, let alone primly stirring his non-caffeine green tea. Now, I can imagine Tom Hartman having some green tea. Tom Hartman, frankly, strikes me as being so daggum cerebral that he probably thinks the green tea out of the cup and into his tummy. He's just that smart. He is smarter by a factor of God only knows what than just about every one of the right-wingers that are bloviating on the air put together. Mike Malloy? Prim? Prim? I think Mike Malloy's got enough manners that he wouldn't hit a woman. But I don't, having listened to Mike since 1987, I don't think there's anybody who could call him prim. He could probably eviscerate the green tea into submission. maybe Stephanie Miller primly sips some green tea with a coaster sitting on a doily knitted or crocheted by God with some aged relative of hers from whom she learned considerable political savvy. I don't know. That's I don't know who Camille Paglia is aiming that at. Whoever they are, they're before the at, he said, with his at hanging in space. I don't know. I know she's not talking about me. She doesn't know I exist. Very few people do. You are like you who share your time listening to this program are like people who know know that great little restaurant in the 4th arrondissement in Paris and ain't telling nobody. Because as soon as everybody else finds out, the place will go to hell. Oh, wait, maybe that was Prim referring to an arrondissement in Paris. You're like people who's got a fishing hole, and you ain't telling nobody where that fishing hole is because the fish is always biting there. There's a couple old cypress knees sticking up and some willow roots. And it's like the smallmouth equivalent of a gentleman's club. But anyway, she's not talking about me. Because I really am. I'm guilty of decaf green tea. Because I think there have been two occasions, where I accidentally consumed caffeine and then crawled in behind the microphone. One of them was the night when I had a hankering for root beer, and Agnes innocently got a can of Barks, poured it over ice, and brought it to me. And I quaffed it, loving it. I love root beer. I just do. And then began to, you know, it's like, honest to God, me on caffeine is like Wile E. Coyote after the earthquake pills. And it's a really unpleasant feeling, so caffeine makes me sick. I OD'd on it during all those years on all those overnight shifts, drinking 2, 3, 4 pots a night. Trying to stay, because, you know, when you're doing the overnight shift, you don't necessarily want, it's not all Venus flytrap, okay? Hey, welcome to the overnight. No, because, I mean, I always felt like I had a responsibility to people who are out there just like me trying to work the overnight shift with, you know, maybe their head bouncing off a cash register somewhere trying to stay awake. So you got to be peppy. But anyway, I can't tolerate caffeine anymore, and I apologize to Camille Paglia for that fact. If it makes me prim, I'm sorry. Snap and snip and chortle snidely. Well, that's great alliteration, the bells, 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 bells. Thank you, Edgar Allan Poe. No, that's more about onomatopoeia, isn't it? Snap and snip and chortle snidely. That's a chortle, I guess. Weighed down by a complacent superiority complex. I confess to the I don't feel weighed down by it. I confess to the superiority complex. I know that my side of this discussion, this debate, is a good, on average, 70 IQ points higher than Glenn Beck or Michael Savage or Hannity or Flimball. I know that their material success is certainly not a function of their genius nearly so much as it is the function of the pre-existing infrastructure that is loaded to catapult somebody who is willing to scream outrageous things into right-wing superstardom. So maybe I'm guilty as charged. Maybe we all are. You know, I think about that phrase, paralyzing sanctimony, paralyzing sanctimony. One way or the other, I've got the emphasis on the wrong syllable. And I think about the down-home, homegrown, straight-up goodness of Guy James. There's nothing... Guy James will not tell you that he is superior to anyone. He just opens his mouth and proves it. Guy James, you just about have to ball bat him to get him to tell you where he went to school or what he studied, because it doesn't matter. He's just having the same good old-fashioned, even though he's in Florida, Midwestern conversation that he had over the fence growing up and has been having all his life. Maybe. So the first question is, who the hell is she talking about? Is she talking about Alan Combs? Is she talking about somebody on the nearly dead Air America? I honestly don't know. And I'm not being critical of her. I think if the medium is ever to succeed, we must engage in some serious navel gazing. We got to figure how we can make the medium work, and that's, you know, for God's sakes, that's why conversation radio exists. Because Guy James and I and John Fox, Mark Levine, Peter Godbold, Rick Goodner, Rick Smith, Billy Shears, Joe Vecchio in years past, Bruce Birch in years past, Ben Birch, constant and ongoing, have all engaged in a dialogue about how we can be different from the right-wing model, and how we can present something that people will find intriguing and engaging, that doesn't involve a compromise in values, and does involve not putting people to sleep. And I read this kind of stuff, and no, it's not pointed at anything the horn does. Again, Camille Paglia doesn't know the horn exists. But I read these words like snap and snip and chortle snidely, and I think, have I ever snapped or snipped or chortled snidely? If anybody's guilty of that on this network, it would be me. But by and large, no. And I don't breakneck vaudeville while liberal hosts are primly stirring their non-caffeine green tea. Anybody who's ever listened to Stephanie Miller's show knows that there ain't nothing prim about the slapstick humor that she brings to bear on a morning show. Primly. Isn't that sort of a snide sort of, I mean, speaking of snipping and snapping and chortling snidely, isn't there sort of something sort of snide in that assertion? Doesn't that smack a little bit of the playground taunts of "you're a sissy"? Isn't that a little bit of bullying language? And then again, of course, in this inquiry right here, the heart and soul of what it is to be liberal and broadcast. We can be introspective of ourselves and our own. And that because the contrasting images of breakneck vaudeville versus primly stirring non-caffeine green tea, don't those have some gender overtones to them? Because they damn sure seem to me. Because if you're going to primly stir any... Prim is a word seldom associated with a male. One has a prim spinster aunt. And you know, what we were talking earlier about the imaging power of radio. I don't know about you, but I say prim spinster aunt. What comes up for you? I'll tell you what happens in my mind. I can see her. She's got iron gray hair. She's got a psyche knot. Her hair done into a psyche knot on the back of her head. The collar of her dress comes up to about her chin. There's some sort of lace work on the and the gown goes, and she's wearing granny boots, and she's sitting in a Victorian living room on velvet-covered furniture that is stuffed with horse hair. The dress she is wearing is a predominant theme of black, perhaps with some sort of lace work or print, perhaps some sort of paisley, tiny paisley figured into it. While you know, those endearing young charms play in the background. You know, the one with the exploding piano key in all the Bugs Bunny cartoons. So just a little something to chew on as we begin the evening. There is other news out there. But I saw these two things, and I've got one more thing to dovetail into it that might create some sort of barely hanging together, fragile, unstable atom sort of theme for the evening. But for right now, let's do the telephone thing. Hey, welcome to the program.
Prim, Stephanie Miller. She's sitting there telling fart jokes as the voice monkey is feeling her up.
Yeah, precisely my point, Susan. I mean, tell me, where is she listening?
Personally, I think she's projecting. I think she's describing herself.
Could be. You know, okay, I didn't read it, but she makes an assertion about talk radio audiences, and she says, the most rewarding aspect of talk radio for me is the callers whose voices are heard nowhere else in the culture, the feisty, super-organized homeschooling moms, the gruffly, stoical, transcontinental truckers, and the fiercely independent and self-reliant small business owners outraged by Washington's tilt toward bailing out corrupt, top-heavy corporations.
She's talking about right-wing radio.
Well, that certainly sounds like a right-wing radio audience, doesn't it? This woman's never listened to any liberal radio.
Yeah, she's just basically picking up, she's using the right-wing's description of liberal talk radio without ever listening to it. Never mind the fact that the last time Stephanie Miller debated the Fairness Doctrine, she showed up with ratings showing that, several of the stations that had been number one against right-wing talk radio like Rush, their owners had flipped them to all sports or right-wing or religion, and now they were so low in viewership, they weren't even rated any longer, but they used to be number one when they were liberal talk. They had the ratings.
And, well, I'm sorry, I thought you were going to go on there, Susan.
You know, they had the ratings, you know, the stations were successful. And that's not what the right wing wants. They're not prepared to allow that. So they flipped them.
Well, this is... I mean, how can you... See, Susan, I'm, and this is, maybe this is why I'm not on terrestrial radio. You can drive trucks through my pause. And, hey, Bob, during that next pause, you think we could work an advertisement in? You know, that could, But seriously, what she describes as breakneck vaudeville, to me is, that dangerously incendiary stuff where people wind up going out and shooting up a church play.
Exactly.
And I don't find it funny.
I don't either. I don't find any right-wing stuff funny. Now, I have yet to see anything. I hereby throw this in. I don't listen to right-wing media. I listen to clips because I won't subject myself to that crap.
Well, I tell you what, here in a minute I'm going to bring it up, but I had an email from our buddy David in Tennessee who did briefly subject himself to some right-wing radio today.
Oh, he took it for the team.
Well, yeah. That, you know, I consider it personal sacrifice anytime anybody does that. What Flimball had to say today about the Somali pirate business is going to blow your mind.
He's probably screaming about Obama claiming all the credit. Never mind.
Oh, no. Don't even try to go wandering around in the mosquito infested, malaria laden swamp that is Flimball's brain. Just wait. I'll make sure I get to it.
There was one point I did want to bring up besides the radio. It was when you were talking about the radio announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about the imagery a radio voice can evoke. To me, that is the same process that you go through when you read a book as opposed to watching a television or a program or a movie.
Well, precisely.
Yeah. And it saddens me to see library after library after library close. Because to me, there's only one great crime in this household of ours. And that's to abuse a book. My kids were brought up with that. You abuse a book, Mama will bust you, but good. Because to me, books were the doorways to space and time and worlds beyond imagining. All you had to do was open it. And I feel so sorry for people who have not been brought up with that love of books. I know you have it. But I see people who, they're not interested in books unless they're on audio tape. But they're not interested in just literally picking up the book and opening it up and reading it. And that is so sad. Because the imagery that your own mind creates is so much richer and so much more detailed than anything Hollywood could ever come up with.
Yeah, that's why movies based on books so often frustrate me.
Yeah, they just make me crazy. 9 times out of 10, if I see a movie has been made out of a book, I'm really, really leery about watching it because at the very least until I've gone out and read the book, because I don't want to ruin it.
You know, that impulse or that sensation is so profound for me, Susan, that I can tell you the first time it hit home for me.
Hmm.
And it's a little bit of nothing. But I'd say it was before I was a teenager. It's certainly before I was a teen, and probably before I was double digits. I read a book called The Island at the Top of the World, fantasy sci-fi piece along the same lines as Journey to the Center of the Earth, or you know, that kind of thing. And I loved it. Oh God, to an almost adolescent mind, the images that it made inside my brain, some of them have stayed with me, you know, because they do that. And then my sister and I, my sister who was considerably older than me by about 15 years, but passed on to me her love of books, in large part that she's responsible for that as much as my mother. Put me to see the movie version when Disney brought it out.
Yeah, and it just...
And I sat there going, but where's the... But they left out the... It didn't happen that way.
Yeah.
And from that day to this, I have always been suspicious of anybody who takes a really good book and tries to turn it into a movie because, you know, there will inevitably be choices made about it that, very rarely do I find that the movie has lived up to the book. Forrest Gump was a book that was maybe a pulp paperback that was maybe a half inch thick.
Yeah, I know, I read it.
And tears rolled down my face. I had to put the book, I couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah.
And then I'd pick it up again, and I was good for three more paragraphs, and I was paralyzed with laughter again.
And they butchered it.
And they turned that thing into an infomercial for Nike, for all intents and purposes. And the whole world went, what a wonderful movie!
Yeah.
And all I could do was sit there and say, well, you dumbasses, you obviously didn't read the book, because Sue the orangutan wasn't there. Remember her? And old Sam, the cargo cult cannibal chess player wasn't there, nor was the cooking pot variation on the grass hut ploy. In the chess matches weren't there.
Well,
there was nothing about meeting John Kennedy in that book.
Yeah, when I was about 10, we moved into a house in Williamsburg, Virginia, a rental. And the previous tenant had left a book behind, now being a confirmed book freak already at that age. I immediately grabbed it, even though it was one of those real thick jobs. And it was Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. I say, cool. Sat down, started reading. And read, and read, and read, and read. And about 3 days later, I come up here and say, wow, that was cool. So I turned it around and read it three more times. So a few years later, I come around and I hear, you know, they come out with a, re-release of Gone with the Wind. Okay, that's cool.
This will not end well.
I'm sitting there watching it, starting it, you know. And, you know, the very first few scenes, you know, where they're getting ready for this garden party.
And Miss Scarlet's getting laced into her corset for the barbecue.
Right.
And Ashley will be there. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Right. I got news for you. I have never, ever, and I've tried this about five times, I have yet to be able to stay awake past the corset lacing scene. It's like second all, whoop, I'm out. I have yet to be able to stay awake long enough to see that movie. It's just incredibly boring. The book is incredibly fascinating. Because all of the backstory and history, and, oh man, hey, you can pick all sorts. And from there, I went into all sorts of history. I started digging into the Civil War and, you know, all this stuff. Hey, I had a high old time that summer. And I started digging into other authors, all this stuff. You don't get that from a movie.
No, you don't.
And it's just...
I don't want to engage in anything that Camille Paglia would consider to be... Oh, what's her phrase? Let me get back to it. Sorry. I don't want to be accused of snipping and chortling snidely, or a complacent superiority complex. But now I tell you what, because movies serve a great purpose. The remake. Let me offer for your consideration the remake of King Kong.
I never saw it.
Well, you don't have to appreciate this.
I saw the original.
I saw the original, the Jessica Lange, and the latest remake. The one with Jack Black. And the special effects were stunning. The movie was okay. It was an okay movie for what movies are. But for me, it was worth the price of admission because you've heard me say on a number of occasions that getting this family ready to go anywhere is like Moses trying to move the children of Israel across Sinai. It's like herding cats, pushing a wheelbarrow full of frogs, whatever analogy you want for how difficult a difficult operation can be with a bunch of disparate personalities. So we go to the movies. We go to dinner first. We then go to the movies. And we're sitting in there, and it's one of those new movie theaters with the stadium seating and everything. And the movie moving picture house is just jam-packed. So there's kids, our kids are behind us, our kids are in front of us, and Agnes and me are in the middle. And Agnes dozes off. She is exhausted. She is absolutely exhausted from the effort of just trying to get the family to the movie theater.
Right.
And she wakes up right at, and it's widescreen, big screen, huge, just short of IMAX. And she wakes up just as a 30-foot Tyrannosaurus Rex head is on the screen staring at her. And the scream of "What the F?" reverberating through that movie theater is a precious moment. Precious indeed.
You're going to catch hell for telling that.
Not if you don't tell her I told it.
Oh, God, that's funny.
But, you know, movies can serve their purpose. God, if that had been in 3D, I can't even begin to conceptualize what would... Yeah. So, you know, just to put a little point of balance on the comparison and contrast.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this, but oh God, you're gonna love this. First of all, two news goodies. Okay, Americans are overwhelmingly disagreeing with our former vice president. Latest polling shows.
That's inspiring. That provides hope.
Go screw yourself.
Go Cheney yourself.
Yeah. The thing that just really blew me out of the water, though, is Justin Clarence Thomas.
Did I miss something?
Oh, God.
He's not out there leaving pubic hairs on Coke cans again, is he?
No. He says, quote, "Today there is much focus on our rights. Indeed, I think there is a proliferation of rights. I am often surprised by the virtual nobility that seems to be accorded those with grievances. Shouldn't there at least be equal time for our Bill of Obligations and our Bill of Responsibilities," unquote. This is from the Uncle Tom of the Supreme Court. This is from a man who hasn't asked a question since 2006.
A bill of, well, no, there is a bill of duties and a bill of responsibilities.
It's called the Constitution.
Yeah, and it's also called the Federal Tax Code.
Yeah.
I mean, if a right winger wants to aim something like that in a sort of scattershot blast at the American culture, I would suggest that those of us in a certain region would suggest that he get a choke for his shotgun so he can narrow the blast a little bit to hit the people who've been ignoring their responsibilities and obligations. Don't let pellets from a blast like that pepper some working stiff holding down three jobs.
Yeah. And by the way, Clarence,
aim that at Wall Street.
Two words. Anita Hill.
Hence my reference, Clarence, to the aforementioned Coca-Cola can. Yes.
Yes, I know. Anyway, it's in a New York Times article. It's just appalling.
Oh, shoot me the linky, would you please?
Yeah, okay, I'll do that. It's just, I can't believe this man, I really will. Yeah, I do believe it. He's classic Bushy.
Bushy, Bush League, pick one, yeah. Susan, good talking to you, dear.
He was talking to students, by the way.
Of course. That's when they pull out those really plum-sounding phony high-minded intellectual things, because if he was well, never mind. I'm not going to go there. At least not right now.
Anyway, love to Agnes and tell her to watch out for them T-Rexes.
If this gets back to her, I'll know. I'll know who told her.
Hey, Agnes and I are friends. You know that.
Yes, but
what can I say?
I know. It'll get bad.
Agnes?
You guys enjoy just keeping it stirred up here for me, don't you?
Hey, we live to serve.
Jesus. With service like this. Take care, Susan.
Okay, Link is on its way.
All right, and bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
News Ninja Susan calling from Columbia City, Oregon, and we keep it rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob.
Brother Albert.
I won't tell Agnes nothing. Us tea drinkers need to stay together a little bit.
That's decaf green tea.
Well, not me. I drink a tea that'd knock, socks off. Nice little chais and super heavy duty greens. And I just love my tea. You know, I drink a coffee too, but, I understand. Yeah, I say, you know how too much caffeine, just like, you know, what happened to you. I don't want what happened to you happening to me. I want to be able to enjoy coffee forever. Sorry.
I know.
I'll learn from Bob in that one.
Do that. When you want that fifth pot, just tell yourself no.
Yeah, especially French press. Can't mess around with that, so I don't even know.
No, French press is the coffee equivalent of freebasing.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think three in a day is our limit, but that's with friends and everybody's hanging out kind of thing. But and to solve the movie issue, you always should watch the movie first. If I hear about, you know, when they do these, you know, 1-2 punches and they're going to, you know, there's a book out that's hot and I can't get to it because my list is too long, and, you know, I have an opportunity to read that book and I know that there's a film coming out, I'll usually just wait for the film. I do that because if I like the film, reading the book is that much better. So it's like, you know, it gives you deeper insight more and more and more. And, you know, I mean, it's really tough to capture everything in a book and put it into a film because, you know, you and I may watch a 17, 20-hour movie or what have you, but some people, you know, just can't handle an hour and 20 minutes, you know, without getting up and twitching, you know. I got that, like my 5-year-old daughter, you know, she just can't sit still for too long. So there is that to contend with, so. Anyhow, of course, there are just the stories I enjoy, and I just like seeing them in action, you know. Of course, you always pick them out, but, you know, I try not to be too picky. I went on a wonderful, we went and visited some friends this weekend, and we're kind of like those foodies, I guess you'd call us. And man, did I taste some outstanding, unbelievable olive oil this weekend.
Honestly, we
had a lot of discussions regarding, you know, what we experienced, and it came to the conclusion that, you know, no wonder the French call us pigs. You see, Americans don't even know why French people call us pigs. We're pigs because we eat crap. If you ever have fresh olive oil with, and then the stuff that...
The stuff that has been coaxed by a 90-year-old olive oil presser, literally coaxed from the fresh olives without bruising their... Yeah, I know. That stuff.
But the thing... Yeah, well, exactly. Well,
it's about and it's about the color of a really nice 10W30 too.
I'll tell you. Well,
a little greener.
There's all kinds. There's so many kinds. You do backflips when you actually see how many different varieties, and each single one is different. And some of them, you know, like they'll have often a really good olive oil, or a fresh olive oil will actually burn a little bit, like pepper, on the back of your throat. And what that is that's the antioxidants in there, you know, kind of tingling the tinglies.
Well, and an olive, it's, you know, I heard someone opine, Albert, that much as others have wondered who was the first human being who ate an oyster, there's a passage in Gore Vidal's book, Creation, a wonderful novel, by the way. Not that I'm name-dropping, I ain't. But he talks about, his character talks about the loathsomeness of the olive. And the fact that they are incredibly bitter to begin with, off the tree. They're just vilely bitter. Inedibly bitter. And they have to be treated one way or another to make them edible. But, you know, once you treat them, they're for those of us who love them, they're heaven on earth. I imagine that really, really fresh stuff does do something like that on the back of the throat, and it might be those antioxidants you're talking about.
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, it is exactly that, and I'll tell you something that's really interesting is, you know, the outline of olives you just laid out is kind of important. If you think about the experience, like here, olive trees don't really grow in America besides, you know, maybe in California and a couple spots that have, you know, Mediterranean type of climate. But, you know, the experience of Americans with olives is not really something that, you know, you would go, oh, about. I mean, who goes, oh, over pimento-filled olives? And don't get me wrong, I love a black olive, you know, I do, but the stuff in the can that, you know, is the premium stuff that most people are, you know, exposed to, I really wouldn't want to use an oil out of that. You know, it wouldn't even strike my, you know, my fancy to do such a thing, but then they tell you it's good for you. So you go and you go to the store and you pick up some olive oil and you taste it and you're like, I guess, you know, whatever. It's good for me. I'm going to eat it. You know, I'll drink a kombucha tea. I don't know if you know what that is, but
no, you're
I'll drink that stuff.
You just ran right past me.
All right, kombucha tea. Kombucha is this old, it's like thousands of years old. I guess cavemen in Asia discovered it. And basically they'll make a tea. And there's a symbiotic fungus bacteria culture that will grow on the tea and ferment it. And as it ferments, it adds all these enzymes and amino acids and, you know, a couple of vitamins here and there, and it changes the whole character of the tea, and it turns into a very detoxifying, cleansing solution. The thing is it's fizzy, really fizzy. It's fermented, so it tastes fermented. And it's not beer, it's tea, so it's fermented tea. And it's an acquired taste, but it does refresh you. It is very invigorating. You do feel better. You know, like you can almost feel your liver kind of, you know, getting rid of, you know how enzymes, you know how those things work. All of a sudden you have one enzyme and, you know, you're good to go and it cleans out your liver. If you're lacking another enzyme, you know, you're turned into Lorenzo from Lorenzo's Oil, you know.
Okay.
So these kinds of things are important to have. Amino acids, as you all, everybody knows, is the base building blocks of protein. So anyhow, this kombucha is an acquired taste. But once, you know, I'll drink it, and I started drinking it because it's good for you. And it might not taste freaking, you know, it might not be like, you know, an 18-year-old white balsamic, you know, fused in with some peaches or strawberries or any of that kind of stuff, which is, oh, my God, Bob. But, you know, it might not be one of those. But, you know, not to stray off too much, people will eat things that taste, you know, like some of these breads that, you know, are good for you. They taste like, you know, pebbles and, you know, sawdust, you know. They don't taste like very good. And I think then, you know, people think they have to eat bad food in order to be healthy. And see, the problem is a lot of the people in Italy, the people in Spain, the people in France, and the people that are, you know, you consider, you know, snobbish regarding food, or people that would look down on Americans because of what we eat and how we do things, you know, they get the first press. When that olive oil sits on a shelf for a year, they won't buy it. Period. They're just not going to buy it. So where does it go? It goes off to England or wherever, you know. And then after a while, the people in England, who they kind of get fresh stuff once in a while, they're like, I ain't buying that anymore. And then where does it go? America. And we go, oh, wow, this is good for us. Let's eat, blah, 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 blah. But we're eating 3-year-old, 5-year-old olive oil. You know what I mean? I mean, I have.
Oh, God, I hope you're wrong.
Well, no, this is what happens. Without a doubt, this is what happens. I mean, not to say we can't get the good stuff in America. I didn't go to Europe, you know, this weekend. You know, the whole thing is it's almost like people don't know it exists. You don't know it can be any better, so you don't even think to look there. Now, when you do taste, and I've got a sampler packet for you, and I'm going to have to be sending that on its way. When you do taste these things, you'll know. Your eyes will just blow up, you'll cry because of the tastes and the flavor, and there's so many different varieties and the combinations, and just you never think these things would come out of, you know, olives. You know, it's like, you know, people don't understand wine because they never really get a good bottle of wine.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm still, and to be honest, Albert, I'm still waiting for that bottle of wine where I taste all those things that the wine people say that are in the taste of that wine.
Bob?
Over notes of cherry laced with hickory nuts picked on a certain Tuesday in September. You know, that kind of writing.
30% dew and butterfly, you know, eyelashes on it.
Right.
Trust me when I tell you, it exists. It's the same, you know, it's the same mindset with pizza or any kind of food, anything that's really big, and there's a reason that it is the way it is. You know, wine gets you a nice little buzz. It's some happy buzz, you know, great. Some of the best evenings ever, you know, sitting around drinking wine with your liberal friends, you know, and being haughty-taughty. You know, it's a great conversation opener, you know, don't push it too much, but everybody knows what I'm talking about when we talk about that. But a good bottle of wine, man, it's good from the first sip on, you know. But however, a good bottle of wine, people who know pay, they'll pay. And a good bottle of wine, there's a new movie out. It's been out for a little bit. It's called Bottle Shock, about how when the California wines defeated the French in their little taste test and blew the world out. Now there's wine grown everywhere, and it's a really good thing for wine in general. However, the bottles of wine that they're talking about, they're out of the league of people like you and I. You know, I mean, $108, $300 for a bottle of wine, 4 glasses of wine, $300. You know, that's kind of tough. That's a tough one to swallow when you can get by with the $20, you know, Australian Shiraz, you know, with the kangaroo and the tribal, you know, Aborigine trip out, you know, art. You know, that kind of stuff you can get away with, you know, when you don't got the change to get, you know, to drop $300 on a bottle of wine that was only made last year. You know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, there is a huge, it's such a dramatic difference. It's no wonder they call us pigs when the people that get the stuff know. Because they're like, you guys are eating the trimming, the crumbs off our, you know, we wouldn't even give that to our animals. I mean, I can't believe you guys eat that kind of stuff and think it's good. You know, no wonder, I mean, you know, everybody who's had a hamburger knows how good they can be. We also know how bad they can be.
Oh.
And that's true. A bad hamburger or a bad steak, it's one of the worst things on earth. But people eat bad steak constantly. A ton of these steak, all-you-can-eat steak buffets, you think that's good steak in there? If you've ever had a nice, you know, ribeye or something like that that's done right with, you know, it's been aged, it's a thick, you know, an inch or two thick, you know what I mean? Come on now, you chew that, that's a different
paper,
world right
paper
there.
Thin slices of Wagyu beef in seared on each side and then arranged in a beautiful in a beautiful floral pattern on a plate in ponzu sauce with little dollops of radish there.
Mm.
I'm still not over it.
And you know what the funny thing is now this is going to branch into another aspect. You know, it's like we have to take care of ourselves. And the best way to take care of ourselves and live a life, no matter how long or short, you know, and this goes right into food. Food is medicine. You know, food is one of these things that, man, it not only feeds your body, it feeds your soul. It's still nurturing you. That little thing you had. Now the problem is how does everybody get to have that stuff? And I think we get everybody to get that stuff by raising the standards. Stop supporting these, you know, like we over here in Wisconsin where I live is, every time I tell you, it's, to me, I think of, you know, it's poor, it's this, we're the West Virginia of Wisconsin. We don't have coal. What we have is cows. And what they want to do is they want to start putting these guys in Indiana with, you know, these agribusinesses. What they're trying to do to my Vernon County here, I mean, miles down my road, we got rid of that coal ash dump, and now they want to put a CAFO, which is a concentrated animal feed operation, where they have, you know, 8,000 cows and 80,000 chickens, and they're all living real tight together. And
yeah, it's an animal concentration camp, and they even use concentration in the name.
Exactly. Now, the beef that you had, that, you know, you're talking the Kobayashi Kobe beef, right? When you talk like that, those animals are fed beer because the beer not only gets them nice and, you know, fat, but it also de-stresses them. It relaxes them. They try to make those animals as relaxed, as content as possible. They try to make them happy and massage it. Oh, you got a little knot there? And we'll take care of that. And those cows, not for nothing, you may be a vegetarian, but, you know, a lot of us are carnivores or omnivores. And, you know, if you're going to eat beef, you want to eat beef that is going to taste good. If you're going to sit there and taste olive oil, you want olive oil. You want good olive oil. Now, granted, you know, there is that. But the thing is instead of sitting here producing bombs, you should be teaching these Palestinians how to, you know, and stop running into their olive groves with, you know, bulldozers. We should allow them to prosper. Prospering by getting everybody access to good olive oil. Everybody raise beef correctly. Treat it right. Treat it, you know, don't sit there and put the animals in these little tiny pens, you know. Let's reinvigorate. There are a lot of people out there that want to be small family farmers. It's affordable to do so. Let's stop sitting there and feeding the lowest common denominator. You know, pizzas and every kind of food that you can imagine. We wonder why, you know, so many people seem backwards. Well, look at the food. I know it's a stretch, but look at the food they eat. You know, they don't even, they go to Walmart, they get these things that are made in these factories, God knows where, it's instantly frozen. You know, if you've watched that show, How It's Made, I'm sure you watch that, you know, it's one of those just mesmerizing little events where you go, oh, look at that machine, you know, but look at that machine do all these things when he's making, and it's making pizzas. You know, not for nothing, when you go to a good restaurant, that chef who made that food for you, right, with that little thing, they put love into that food. They put attention, even if it's not love, even if they don't love you, they love what they're doing, and they put attention into it. So when you have a place that people love what they're doing, as a restaurant can clearly show you, you get something that will stay with you forever. You will remember that meal forever, and you know you're always judging every other meal against that meal, and not for nothing, these people not only love what they did, they had the ingredients made by people that love what they did, and so on and so forth. Hence, what, you know, something like that. It's artwork being created. We should be eating artwork. Everybody should be doing these things. You know, we talk about health care and all this other stuff. Well, heck, the better we eat, the better we're going to be in terms of health. You know, if we're stuck eating these, you know, greasy, microwavable hamburgers and, you know, 10-year-old olive oil with congealed fat on the side for $20 a bottle. Oh, my God. It's unbelievable. I don't know, just to ramble on a little bit more. I had a talk with this olive oil and vinegar, you know, distributor guy, and it was actually a female, and her and I chatted, and I said, I want this olive oil here in my community, my little local community. And, she, you know, so I talked to her about this, and she, you know, she liked what I said, and this and that. She gave me all these free samples. And today, you know, this morning I had to go get milk, and so I went down to my little local co-op, and I brought these to him. Now, this little local co-op, it's a health food store. Think about it. This is my health food store in this area, and the health food store has olive oil that's so old, there's congealed fat on the side of the bottle. Now, you want to support your local group? I understand that.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. And you still want $15 a bottle for this stuff. You know, people are going to take it because, you know, they think it's good for them. It can't be good for you if it's broken down like that. I mean, that's the whole thing of olive oil. You know, that's why they call it a low, you know, it's a low saute kind of heat. You know, because you don't want to, you know.
No, it smokes. It smokes if you look at it hard.
Exactly. Exactly. So you got to be real gentle with it, and you know that's another part of cooking that maybe a lot, you know, home ec should really teach instead of let's bake you know Betty Crocker brownies today. You know, like, let's actually, you know, I remember when I went to say it was a joke. I knew how to cook way better than these teachers were trying to teach these kids how to cook. It was unbelievable. Anyhow, you know, olive oil, you know, if you get it too hot, it's not good for you anymore. You know, if it sits around and it's antioxidants and everything, its fatty acids break down, it's not going to be good for you. The reason omega-3s are good for you is because they're omega-3s, not omega-2 point or whatever, however they break that down with numerics and numbers and what have you. You know, it's not good for you when it's not omega-3 anymore. You know, it breaks down into really nasty kind of things, and you don't need that. So anyhow, you know, I went down there, and you have to see the eyes on this guy. He didn't know. This is the health food store guy who orders the olive oils and salad dressings and things of that nature. He didn't know that olive oil existed like that. Something that, you know, literally it exists like this. Are you kidding me? We could sell it. People would just buy bread daily, you know, their daily bread like they do everywhere else, you know, in the world. They get their bread and, man, they'd be happy with a little olive oil to dip in it because it tastes like, you know, flowers and, you know, grass and a little peppery aftertaste with a little artichoke, you know, backslide there, and you know, as it fades off your tongue. I mean, you know, those kinds of things are why food is good, and life is what we're about eating. So we might as well eat as good as everybody can. And I think the first step in doing that is making, you know, these ethical movements, you know, changing the ethics of the agribusiness. You know, changing the ethics.
Well, there's that, and there, you know, you've just put the little the little church key into the whole cultural can, and the worms are squirming out of the top, so to speak. Because Albert, there's that, but as you were sitting there talking about cooking, you know, there was a time. Oh dear, he's geezering. Yeah, I can feel the geezer moment coming. There was a time in this country when there was a class called home economics.
Mm-hmm.
And the class in home economics was traditionally taken by females.
Mm-hmm.
I reject that. I refuse that idea that cooking is so... I don't believe there's anything in this world that is women's work with the possible exception of lactating, okay? I don't believe in men's work or women's work or children's work or aliens' work or nothing. Okay, it's inherently bigoted. But I still have recipes copied by hand in a little green metal box that my mother copied onto index cards sometime between 1939 and 1943 in a home economics class. In a building that now sits empty and unused 2 miles down the road from me. And there's nothing in there that says thaw out a or open a can of.
Mm-hmm.
It is what you and I would refer to as scratch cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise going by the moniker of real cooking.
Yeah, or a vital life skill that got us to where we are today.
Hello, yeah.
You know, I mean, and not that I don't want to jump the gun on you or anything, but I just wanted to make this point. You know, they cut these classes out, and what do they put in? You know, we got to have our sciences. Well, heck, there's a science behind food and quality and this and that.
We were having a family conversation yesterday. And we were talking about sciences, and I was off on my usual tangent of you three will go to college. And I get real pushy when I start talking college with my kids. Maybe it's a mistake. Maybe I'm driving them away from it. I don't know.
It's because you care. You care so much. You know it's important. And
yeah.
You want to see them.
But at any rate, so I'm off on that, and I'm telling the story of my chemistry teacher in high school, blah, blah, blah. I've told it on the air. But chemistry is, Agnes added something to it, talking about how there are there's chemistry in everything, and then I said, you know, you all three of you love playing around in the kitchen, cooking is chemistry.
Yes. Uh huh. absolutely. It's absolute chemistry.
There's not a hell of a lot of difference between applying the flame of an alcohol burner to the bottom of a test tube and applying flame or heat to the bottom of a skillet to make something yummy happen in said skillet. But again, it's been lost in the curriculum. What we have now, however, I don't know how it is where you are, Albert. And I hesitate to even go down this road because I don't want to be taken as sounding like some sort of we got to go back to the good old days conservative. All right, because they're idiots. But that class that used to be called home economics has now been replaced, if I'm recalling correctly, and I could be wrong, but it's been replaced in the curriculum around here with something that is euphoniously called life skills.
Okay.
And life skills is, it is, to be fair, reality-based. Because what it is doing, among other things, is teaching young people how to deal with the fact. And in bigger cities and in bigger school districts, they have bigger problems. But it's in large part it has to do with, among other things, teaching young teenage women who damned well ought not be mothers yet how to be mothers now that they are. And it goes hand in hand with the fact that, you know, and what are you gonna do? I mean, if we want to keep kids in school and not have them out on the street, barely educated, poorly educated, ignorant, and you know, just fodder for a life that is, you know, nasty, brutish, and short. You want them in school, so you got to deal with their reality on the ground. So we got schools with daycare centers in them, so that the 10th grader can keep on being a 10th grader and not have to drop out of school to be a full-time mommy. I mean, these are momentous questions. Well, truly, they are.
Well, you got to take a potentially, you know, negative experience like that. We should do everything we can to make it a more positive experience. I mean, you know, we want everybody to achieve, you know, the highest level of their potential. So if a 10th grader has, you know, well, they made a mistake, everybody's entitled to that. But if we kind of help them, assist them to make it not something where it's, you know, man, I might as well just drop out. I might as well just become a prostitute or anything else. Or, oh, man, my husband beats me. Oh, we got to teach people to respect themselves a lot more. You know, you don't want to sound like a conservative, but man, we should be marrying some of these things together. You know, we should be taking, you know, home.
Well, yeah, and it leaves the schools, Albert, and it goes out into the world. If, for instance, a family of not great means, let's say, for instance, mine. First of all, if everybody in this house was to go to a restaurant together, it would take two vehicles to get us there, or two runs, because there are our four kids, Agnes and me, that's six, my son-in-law, that's seven, and two infants, that's nine. I got eight is enough, beat by one. But anyway,
those big vans.
Now that's nine people going out to eat. You're at $20 by the time you've gotten done ordering the iced teas or pop or whatever. That's why Frugal Daddy always orders ice water and puts a little phony sweetener in it and squeezes a lemon into it and has poor man's lemonade. Because the phony sweetener at least dissolves. The sugar won't. Otherwise, I'd use the sugar. But never mind.
Please, Bob, use the sugar. Please.
It don't dissolve. I might as well just put the lemon in the water and not have any sweet, which I also frequently do. Because you can't, again, it's that chemistry thing, Albert. Sugar doesn't dissolve in cold water.
Stir it.
You stir it till hell freezes over, but it doesn't go into suspension. It sinks to the bottom of the glass.
Well, back to chemistry then. Aspartame degrades into wood alcohol below, you know, at 95 degrees, what have you, which is the temperature in your body. So,
I get the point anyway. But anyway, but it, we're at $20 by the time the drink order's taken.
Yes, sir.
And we're not talking about being out at a good restaurant. We're talking about Shoney's, where everything's out of the can or out of the freezer. Now, they do some good things with that. I don't know who supplies them with their blue cheese dressing, but that's some corporate food I can eat. They got the best blue cheese dressing of anybody out there this side of Hooters. Don't start on me. Don't start with the Hooters. They just got good blue cheese dressing, okay? And I love blue cheese dressing.
Oh, I can't go to Hooters. And I'm a big UFC fight fan, and I kind of have no choice if I want to go out with friends, you know, watch a fight. Yeah, so I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I understand. Yeah. But anyway. But for a family like mine, even trying to eat on the cheap, Shoney's, you're at $100. Easy, without trying. And it ain't cooking. No offense to the people who work there. They work hard. The tables are weighted appropriately, and the food is prepared, comes piping hot from the kitchen and everything. But it ain't cooking. It's not creating. It's opening. It's like automated cooking, where you put the burger on, 3 minutes later you turn the burger, 2 minutes later you put the cheese patty on the burger, then you...
And spray flavoring on it.
Yeah, right. But anyway, there's another cultural question to be answered about how we take people on, how do we expose people who are on the low end of the economic spectrum to good cooking, so that either for the most part, they won't be able to purchase it in a restaurant, because if you want to pay people enough to cook, you got to charge enough that folks like me can't go to the restaurant.
But secondly,
if we can teach people to make it at home, we are ahead of the curve. And I'm not talking about any particular. I'm not saying that, you know, I want an America where poor people hand roll their own sushi. It ain't for everybody. But simply busting through the cultural paradigm of this country is working you to death, and therefore the most you can hope for is fast food and a quickly rotting pancreas inside your living body.
Yeah. Well, they talk about West Virginia, you know, and that's where you live, and I'd imagine that, yeah, sure, not everybody has a large piece of land, but I'd imagine, you know, it's kind of like where you live is kind of like where I live, and there's, you know, many people with at least an acre or a quarter acre or something like that. And man, you know, as long as we're going to be sitting here talking about being sustainable, you know, we got to sit here, you know, we're going to get these solar panels on the roofs and the windmills everywhere. I actually had I saw windmills in the moonlight on the trip. I made sure to take a diversion down to the solar wind farm down in Dodgeville, which provides some of my power and Madison's power and so on and so forth. And windmills in the moonlight, let me tell you something. I have to wake up the kids to check that out. And I hope one day you get an opportunity to do that with your children as well, because it's something magical to see these windmills just moving, just as it is anyway. You know, it's like you're a kid watching a pinwheel for your first time. But this time, you know it's providing energy to the grid. So on that wavelength and on that vibe, if we're going to be sitting here making ourselves more energy sustainable, we should also be making ourselves, well, if we're going to make a kind of healthcare we're talking about, we have to, of course, the poor are the ones that are going to have the, you know, that's the ones that everybody's afraid of putting on healthcare. Oh, these 40 million uninsured, they're all a bunch of deadbeats. Oh, they're a bunch of poor. They don't do it. They can't afford it. They don't get enough jobs or education, what have you. Okay, well, these are the people that they're afraid of. Well, let's try to make all, you know, these people, and by building the soil up, everybody else, you know, let's get everybody to eat healthier. You know, the healthier we eat, the less, you know, these processed foods and sodiums and fake sweeteners and everything else that people are eating, the better we're going to do. Sure. You know, there's going to be the Donald Rumsfelds out there from, you know, that made NutraSweet, and they're going to be these guys that have their pull, and they're going to sit there and try to, you know, stop this. But this has to be grassroots, just like, you know, local green power has to be, you know, at the same level, grassroots. This stuff has to be, you know, where we almost, in a sense, demand. You know, maybe a tax credit or tax, you know, instead of tax credits for Hummers, let's get tax credits for greenhouses. Let's get, you know, let's do like things of that nature. You know, heck, let's, instead of, you know, helping out Monsanto, let's help out Burpee or some of these other seed companies or that with Heirloom Seeds for Change. You know, these guys will sit there and do that, and they're going to make sustainable seedings instead of all these, you know, Frankenfood genetically Terminator seeds and all those other crappy genetics with all that stuff that who knows how good it is for us. Heck, we've been eating it for a couple of years. It's not even, you know... You know, it's not, we don't know what's going to happen down the road, and it's almost one of those things you just don't want to tinker with. You know, those are the trilithium crystals in there. Don't be touching them with your hands. They work. Just leave them. They're, we monitor them. They're fine. You know, don't mess with that kind of stuff. We don't want to be sitting out here in the middle of the demilitarized zone with, you know, Romulan warships outside of us. Come on now. We got to survive this thing. We got to sit here and keep our ship in tip-top shape. And the part of our ship is our human beings, and we need to eat healthy. You know, the healthier everybody's eating, maybe the more they take care of the land. The more, you know, and then obviously as this big snowball goes down the, you know, down the hill and creates an avalanche of people sitting there going, wait a minute, we can't be burning coal. Wait a minute, we can't be doing this. I don't want my tomatoes with that crap just dusting on it from the air and the smokestack. We don't need this kind of stuff. You know, that's the world I can see. You know?
Yeah, and the, you know, the opposite side of that, Albert, that I'm glad you mentioned that because, well, it gives me an opportunity to go somewhere that was already in my head. If you look, if it, you know, I mentioned the fact that these massive layoffs have been hitting the coal fields here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a few nights ago talking with Wayne that we talked about how one coal company said it was rationalizing jobs. Dundon rationalized right into bankruptcy.
Sure.
But I got to thinking about this because at first blush, when you hear of 600 people anywhere being thrown out of work, your first inclination as a human being is to go, oh, God, what will they do? Even if those are people who were, you know, blowing up your home.
You should do the real Christian thing to do. What would Jesus do in that aspect? Let's look for something for these folks to get, you know, get done.
Yeah. D9 caterpillars do things other than destroy homes.
Exactly.
They do other things besides running over little American girls in Israel.
Yes, sir.
But anyway, I got the, so my first inclination was to have some degree. And I still have it, some degree of identification and concern for the people who have been thrown out of work, because whether they stand with me, I stand with them, because there's two kinds of people in this world, them that work and them that don't. They work. Their bosses don't. Now, just because they can't see that division doesn't mean that I by definition have to adopt their blindness. So that's my first inclination. You know, these poor, you know, because, you know, they got a lot, you know, when these mountain removers and so forth stand and scream at you, what they're hollering is, how am I going to feed my family? I mean, they've been taught to holler that. I don't want to go on welfare. How am I going to feed my family? Okay? I mean, I've heard it. And it's a fair question.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get past the initial sort of negative response of, well, dumbass, you can start by not destroying my home and then driving 50 miles away to yours. You know, once you get past the negatives, you start thinking about the real answers to that. I kid you not, since the news came down, Albert, I've been thinking about it. And I realized what's happened. These people who have been laid off, these working people who have been laid off, my fellow West Virginians, who probably, based on Massey's statement that they have already extracted 95% of the coal that they intend to extract for calendar 2009, means that we're talking about 8 months of unemployment at the very least, and perhaps permanent.
Jeez. But this is an opening. This is a window of opportunity.
Well, it is. But the other side of it is, I realized, I stopped for a minute and went, Bob, you dumbass. You're being suckered. You're being used as bad as the workers themselves are. what's going on here? And then I took dot A and I drew dot B and I got my little straight edge out and I drew a line between dot A and dot B. And what's going on here? Dot A was what I heard 2 or 3 weeks ago, the squealing about Obama's carbon tax and his light switch tax. And how it's going to put everybody out of work and he's going to tax the coal industry into bankruptcy. All right.
Mm-hmm.
That was dot A.
Mm-hmm.
Dot B where this was these layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle, there's dot A sub one or A prime or whatever, or maybe it's A, B, and C. I don't know. And that is the action, the recent modest action by the Obama Environmental Protection Agency to review some mountaintop removal permits that haven't even started yet. Okay, reviewing those permits doesn't keep people from being employed. Reviewing those permits doesn't put people out of work. Nobody's working on those sites yet. These were all working sites. These were underground and above ground as well. And then, like something out of the blue, Albert, I went, holy hell, these are some of the meanest-spirited, ugliest, most cynical sons of bitches self-made, ever to draw breath on the planet. They have preemptively put these people out of a job to make a political point.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir.
You want to see what that carbon tax is going to look like? Look at this here. 600 miners out of work. Is that what you want, President Obama? You was planning on running for re-election, wasn't you?
Well,
or maybe we can just start calling you President Carter Part Two.
Well,
the attacks are out there on the United Mine Workers. The United Mine Workers endorsed Barack Obama, and look where it done got him. I've heard it. It's already been said.
Well, tell you what. They're so desperate. And that's all they got. If they, you know, people, I think people are going to start to see. I hope West Virginia, you sit there and you'll see what's happening everywhere else. You know, we're going to start to see these things, you know, with wind and this and that and solar. And eventually you guys are going to have to, you know, the people that are unemployed, you know, at the same time, they're going to be sitting there looking at alternatives. You know, maybe they're just on there. You know, they're unemployed. They, you know, they're at the clinic. They pick up a magazine. They look and they see windmills. You know, they see the noise. They'll see these kinds of things. They'll run into Coal River Mountain Watch and what they want to do and everybody else. The wind farms that you guys can have and say, you know what? Maybe it's a good thing we didn't destroy that mountain. Heck, maybe I can get a job fabricating some steel or laying some concrete or helping drill a hole or laying wire or maintenance on these, you know, the machines that, you know, they have 6,000 parts. Maybe we can open up a factory. You know, these kinds of things that, you know, as long as I think we start communicating these things, just you and I putting this into the universe, those kinds of things are going to make it happen. You know, I think we just need to time the jump correctly. And now I think, you know, it's getting to be that time. You know, man, they're going to stop. This coal power plant, they were going to build a clean coal, and where they're not doing that, and they're looking at phasing out the power plant here. That's huge. That's gigantic. We burn coal from West Virginia. I can go look it up. We burn coal from West Virginia here, and that's going to be big. Now we're going to have wind. We're not going to need coal. We're not going to need what you have. We don't want that olive oil on it with congealed fat anymore. And you guys, you know, people.
That just, yeah. That, you've given me an image to hang on to for a while with that.
Not good. It's just not good. I mean, I don't mind getting a little beeswax in my honey every now and then, but that's a little different, you know. I mean, but hopefully, you know, we can sit here. Maybe we should push these kinds of things. You know, the Victory Garden, you know, that line of consciousness about the Victory Garden, that's still there, you know. You know, Michelle Obama did plant that big garden out there and that greenhouse guy. I mean, these are the kinds of targets that we need to be.
And the corporatists are still pissed.
Oh, good, 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 good. Who cares about them? You know, they don't care about us. We don't care about them. We're just going to do what we're going to do. We're going to put victory guards. You know, heck, who needs to be, you know, blowing money on gasoline to mow your freaking lawn and it's not even, you know, and turn 2 days later you got to go do it again? It's all that wasted effort. You could have been, you know, just tenderly taking care of some tomatoes and some, well, one squash. Don't grow too much zucchini. That's the one. You got to watch the zucchini. It'll take over. But anyway.
It's an alien vegetable. It really is.
Oh, it is. We don't have to worry. As long as we got zucchini, we can feed the earth. It's ridiculous. It's unbelievable.
You got to pick them small, though, because tough zucchini sucks.
Oh, but then you got to pick the seeds out. Oh, it's just unbelievable. It's so much work. But, yeah, you're exactly right. You know, so, you know, people go, you know, hey, grow your own vegetables. Do these kinds of things. Take this personal responsibility. You know, there ain't nothing but you love a hamburger. Who doesn't love a hamburger? Well, how about your own? You know, the people, I think they think growing their own vegetables is demeaning. Do you know what I mean? Like,
what?
They think they're going to lose something. No, they do. People act like that. They're like, oh, man, I just buy it at the store. Oh, man, I don't have to worry about that. You know, like they almost feel like if they can't be seen at the store, you know, pulling up with their little SUV, you know what I'm talking about, and they can't go buy some guacamole because we're having friends over for, you know, for guacamole dip. And
bought guacamole?
Oh, yeah, of course. Now, heck, I don't have a greenhouse. I couldn't grow guacamole up here. But
no, know. But I can go to the store and buy a damn avocado. Well, I mean, guacamole, yeah, huh? I've seen it on the shelves. I confess I've tasted it once.
Hmm.
And it tasted like guacamole the way that, I don't know, that cardboard is to solid oak.
Mm-hmm.
It was a shadow of the thing it was attempting to be.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my God, I mean, guacamole's guacamole because it's easy.
But see, that's what, you know, I mean, when we got pasta pre-made on the shelves, you know, and come on, you got microwave it. What? That's just a hideous thing, hideous thoughts. But, you know, back to the line. You know, the line of thought here, you know, heck, if we can get people, you know, to eat their own that is grown correctly, you know, they would sense the food would taste so much better and it would be half pride that they actually did it. You know, I mean, and we would get people to, be, you know, care about the land and all that other stuff. And
oh, yeah, well, see, if you go to CRMW.net, Albert, and you read the mission statement of Coal River Mountain Watch, you will find that the mission is to end mountaintop removal and rebuild sustainable communities. And that word rebuild is important in there because up until big coal came and began having its way with Appalachia, there wasn't a non-sustainable community here.
Yeah.
So rebuild sustainable communities. And one of the things that I'd love to see, I've even talked to people over here, because I live a good distance from the Coal River Valley. But I've talked to people around here and said, you know, we've got a university extension service, you know, WVU extension service. There's a county extension agent in every county. We could leverage some of that. See how Wall Street speak even sneaks into talks about what leverage. We could use some of that. And we could set up community centers with relatively little money, and I think this is just a brilliant idea all over the country. Community kitchens, okay, where people are free to come and bring their produce and do their own work and can their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or freeze dry it or whatever. But you know, honest to God, commercial scale kitchens, you know, hygienic, clean, with people who can teach those who don't know how to do it, people who do know how to do it, extending their knowledge, and teaching others.
Yes, sir.
And then, okay, here's the fun part. So you don't get charged for this.
Mm-hmm.
What you do instead is you give a portion of what you have just prepared, and that is in turn used to feed your local areas hungry. What you'd be doing is you would be offsetting or augmenting the food stamp program. So that maybe there would be some things that it would not be necessary for folks to spend precious food stamp resources on.
Yes, sir.
Instead of having to go and buy Hunt's or who's ever canned tomatoes, you could have a few jars of home canned real good ones.
Yes, sir. That's right. And
we're not talking about massive amounts of money. You know, we're throwing around great, like I said before, we're throwing around crazy dollar figures. Trillions and stuff that we can't conceptualize.
Mm-hmm.
But to put in community kitchens, say with two of those big industrial Viking, ranges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the restaurant quality ones. You're into a few thousand dollars, but in the long run, it's chump change.
That's right. You could even help the students, you know, the students that, you know, this is a school. This is a school attachment you're talking about, right? You said West Virginia. I'm sure that there's some culinary schools and so on and so forth, and that can be part of their credit, you know.
Sure.
You know, helping to teach these people and show them how to do it is part of, you know, like my one of my best friends, Dave, you know, he's going to school down in Chicago for the culinary arts as we were visiting him this weekend, you know, and I'm sure he would like that because it's part of the just interaction with people. And, you know, as if you're going to be a chef, well, you got to have good communication skills and you got to be able to tell, you know, your people, your sous chefs and everybody else what they need to do so you guys can operate efficiently. Yeah, I could see that being, you know, huge. And people could volunteer if they want, or they can do this and they do that. Your line cooks, everybody can go in, you know, and do these kinds of things. And local gardeners, I mean, you know, not for nothing. You know this more than most, Bob, but, you know, it feels good to give back. It feels good to be able to produce something and then give it to somebody, you know, and especially somebody who would need it. You know, and I'll tell you, not everybody can go and get the, you know, 50-jar pressure cooker that you'd need, or, you know, to really do, you know, a lot of the stuff in a shorter period of time, or have even the space to, you know, cool the jars or whatever, you know, however you're going to do that. You know, so having these community tools, if you're going to make a big batch of bread, you know, having a big Hobart, you know, and you can't afford one of them, you know, kitchen maids or kitchen aids, you can't afford that kind of thing, and you can go make a bunch of loaves of bread, you know, get your dough ready, all those kinds of things. That kind of stuff, man, would help people that, you know, may not want to cook because they can't afford, you know, to have any other pans except Teflon. We got to remove the Teflon, you know, the Teflon separations between, you know, our communities and our schools. And I think we need to marriage all that stuff, get it a little bit tighter, you know, and literally we can do these things on a shoestring. I totally. It would probably wind up, you know, the good that it would do for the community would pay back tenfold. You know, just like you pointed out, if you don't got to sit there and, you know, put as much food stamps, which that doesn't buy people good food. It just gets them the, you know, the machine-made garbage, you know, the Soylent Green. That's all that gives them. Yeah, you know, that sounds like a good idea, Bob. I like that idea. I like that.
Every
community can use that. Everybody. Especially cities. You know, cities where people can get these little community gardens. You've been seeing that, and then they did that in Los Angeles. They tried to destroy it. They're doing it in Brooklyn and, you know, even Manhattan, you know, these community gardens where these old lots that are, you know, run down. And other communities are starting to take over and plant crops for their families and, you know, vegetables and all that stuff. And, yeah, and, you know, a lot of schools could probably, a lot of communities could use that without a doubt. That's a great idea. That's, yeah.
And, I mean, that's not an Appalachian thing.
Mm-mm.
You know, I would love to see, and maybe that, maybe, you know, they said that Michelle Obama's been kind of casting about for what her, because every first lady has to have a cause, or, you know, her shtick. I guess, well, if you were married to Dim Leader, you'd be into literacy too. That was Laura Bush's. But anyway, maybe this garden at the White House is more than it is more than maybe they realize what it is.
Mm.
Maybe this is because, well, Agnes and I have talked about this prospect of trying to get trying to get an organic garden going up at the high school. And doing it with permaculture, yada yada yada, you know, as minimal carbon footprint as possible, no pesticides, no sprays, no poisons.
Yeah.
And having the class that was into doing it, because it keeps growing when school is out and there's nothing, we'd have to find somebody willing to continue supervising it and so forth. But letting the students somehow or another get some sort of credit for continuing to work it through its useful life and into its fallow phase.
Mm-hmm.
A
lot of work. It is work to maintain a nice organic, you know, productive garden. It does take work, and you know, there's ways you can do that kind of stuff. And you know, they can take kitchen scraps, and you know, the science, the biology class can make worm farms, and you know, they can. You know, that might be middle age, you know, middle school kind of thing, you know, to do, but you know, or even elementary school, where you know the kids are making worm casings for the garden at the high school, or maybe even the elementary school should have a garden too. You know, a lot of these things, you know, I mean, you know, the younger we start it, the better off.
I'd love to see it get going, Albert, country, and you know what, they are victory gardens, in the purest sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to, I mean, how can teaching people how to fend for themselves, you know, this is that, you know, that Jesus thing about teaching a man to fish, you know, how can sitting there and showing somebody how to raise a seed to fruit and then to take that fruit and to make world-class food? You know, when we were discussing, you know, our culinary little vacation this weekend, you know, The Italians knew how to cook, and they brought it to France, and then they brought it to Spain. You know, it was like, you know, eventually we stopped eating with our hands, you know. And so this is, I think in a sense, you know, this, you know, changing, you know, just changing the outlook of people that people have on food will have just ramifications throughout, you know, our civilization. You know, the kinds of things where, you know, heck, you know, kids are going to care, their hands are going to be in the dirt. You know, and there's something about that dirt that gets into your soul, you know, and you start to care about that dirt. You know, you want to nurture it, you want to take care of it, and, you know, you'd hate to see any dirt, you know, with a kilometer of coal slurry on it or freaking polluted with mercury. You want to take, you know, you want to grow the best vegetables or the best whatever you can, you know, you don't poop where you eat, you know, you don't do that kind of stuff, you know, you don't poop where you sleep, and you know, you want to take care of your backyard, and by taking care of your backyard, everybody else takes care of their backyard, and then, you know, the whole of the backyards are nice, and everybody's taken care of, and we don't have to worry about half the things we're currently, you know, stuck up on and hung up on, and, you know, a lot of our problems could be helped lubricated with such a movement to make people more aware and to, you know, to know what good food tastes like and to understand how to produce it and take care of it. I see that as one of those, you know, it's like breathing. You know, eating is right next to breathing, and, you know, and drinking and all that stuff, and we're all downhill, and we're, you know, everybody's downstream, and, you know, these kinds of things are important for us to get anywhere. And, you know, if we're eating garbage and everybody has hypertension.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly, just like mathematics, computers, and people, you know. I mean, you could tie these things in together, make people, I think the closer you can tie things in, you know, like if you understand, you know, if you take away those Teflon coatings like I was talking about, and you show people how, you know, science has a real world application, you know, this is like in your real life, everyday life. You may not, you know, like there's so many things they teach us in school that we never use again. You know, we don't ever think about, you know, these bare, you know, we get the bare minimums on your earth sciences and this kind of stuff, but, you know, it's something different about, you know, you always hear those teachers, yeah, they're the ones that take their kids out so they can touch this stuff with their own hands, you know, that they can sit there and smell it and taste it and, you know, those kinds of things, you know. It's just like, you know, when you isolate a human being, it only takes them, you know, 72 hours to start, or less, to start losing it. You know, we need interaction with things, you know, to think that the organism that we live on, You know, if that, to think that we can be successful and survive and thrive without having a connection to that, you know, is the same as putting somebody in solitary confinement. You know, you where the collective has to be in tune with the with this organism. As I say, you know, this is our enterprise, and we got to make sure our thrusters work and everything else. You know, we have to make sure that our ship is tip top, and you know, we don't have nothing. You know, we can't live on Dune or Arrakis. You know, with all the people that we have, we can't do any of that. You know, we really need to take care of that kind of stuff, and those are the things that are very important. You know, I mean, what happens when this planet gets hit with a big coronal mass ejection? You know, and the electromagnetic force of the sun CME destroys all circuitry on the planet. You know, these are things that can happen. It could happen tomorrow. You know, it's not. Everybody relax. But you know, and then we can't communicate anymore. You and I can't talk anymore. And that would, you know, that would break my heart. You know, not to be able to chat with you. But then again, you know, your cars won't work, and you know, this won't work. And you know, if we have a bunch of people that don't know.
Yeah, and oddly enough, you're describing a natural phenomenon and not something, as Newt Gingrich likes to think, the North Koreans might do to us.
Seriously, exactly. What's more important to watch out for? You know what I mean? It's like you put your seatbelt on when you get in the car, you know, because things happen. You know, I ain't worried about North Korea. You know, I ain't worried about terrorists. I mean, honestly, in all actuality, the thing that the fear part that's closest to my heart right now is like 20-year-old girls. Oh my God, my girls are going to be 20 one day. That scares me. But you know, especially
it ain't. Newsflash: it ain't easy at 12.
Oh,
don't think you're time. don't think you've got that long before the horrors set in.
I know. I'm just saying, but to think, you know, that's one thing. But then to think about them in a world that just don't even, that's not in touch with itself is, you know, it'd be like encouraging them to get married to a sociopath or something like that. You know, somebody that I know has got damaged goods. You know, someone's not in touch with themselves.
Oh, look, I'm already working on the boyfriend speech. I've been working on it for about 16 years. At this point, I've got it honed down to high. You know, I'm like one of those Zen monks who's been working on a haiku for a lifetime. You know, it's only 17 syllables, but those 17 syllables are so important. Right now, I'm stealing a line from Clueless. Son, I've got a shovel and a 45. You will not be missed.
Yeah, it's good one. See, that's why we need. That's why we need our guns. Daddy's dead because of daddy's fear. But
yeah. Oh God, it's true. You know, when you've got a little girl, you've got all the little boys in the world to worry about.
Absolutely.
All right, brother. Good talking to you, Albert.
Hey, as usual. All right, man. I'll keep it going, and let's have a nice quiet week with some nice progressive progress, if we can.
Here, right? Here. I like it. Take care, Albert.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye bye.
I haven't taken a break during the show. If you are on hold, please remain that way. We will come right to you out of the break. Just something for your edification that just rolled in before we do go to the break. Just rolled in from our buddy David in South Carolina. Bob, just please click on to CNN and tell me I'm not tripping. The top story is about an alligator under a car in Florida? Damn! And I thought, okay, all right. And I went there, and, you know, there, Phil Spector convicted of second-degree murder. You know, but lo and behold, live developing story, top of the page. Gator wrestled out from under car in Orlando, Florida. Now, Albert, and maybe it's unfair. There's Albert and I talking about how we reinvent community, how we sustain community, how we literally live on this planet. And we've talked about other issues. I mean, you know the nature of this program. But even in the wider world of other stuff, the aftermath of the Somalia pirate thing, and as Preston pointed out, so clearly. There's more to the pirate story than meets the eye. But all kinds of stuff out there. And the live developing story on CNN is gator wrestled out from under car in Orlando, Florida. I mean, to be fair, as a former newsie, if it was gator wrestled out from under car in Manhattan, gator wrestled out from under car in Anchorage, gator wrestled out from under car in Detroit, it would have news value. But it's Florida. Their state university's team mascot is a damn gator. And they do that thing in the stands like they're the opening. Come on! Who's working at CNN now? Gator wrestled out from under car in Orlando, Florida. Watch now live on CNN.com. This is CNN. I'm so ashamed. Gator wrestled out from under car in Orlando, Florida. Dear God, isn't there something else I could be doing? Who's the webmaster? Who's typing this stuff? Who's putting this out there? Who picked up the phone? This is the assignments desk. Need a live developing story banner on the website. Gator wrestled out from under car in Orlando, Florida. And the guy on the other end? The guy at the web desk? Is he going, are you drinking again? No, really. Put it up there. That's all we got tonight? That's it? Isn't there a missing white woman somewhere? Just put the gator up there. All right. Merciful God. Other stuff to go to as well as your calls coming back out of the break. A song I've had on my mind since Albert mentioned something about it last week. We're going back to our buddies XTC for this. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on to get through to the program. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Brock.
11 past the hour. Just a little, before we go back to the phones, just a little postscript. I was kindly provided by Sophie in the chat room with a little piece of writing. And, you know, we started out the program talking a little bit about some writing on radio and, you know, broadcast and art and yada, yada, yada. And some comments by Camille Paglia. I don't know. But, first off, ELO, den mother to the chat room, sent me a quote from Paglia for Salon from November 2008, in which she describes, in which Paglia states, and I quote, "I like Sarah Palin, and I've heartily enjoyed her arrival on the national stage. As a career classroom teacher, I can see how smart she is, and quite frankly, I think the people who don't see it are the stupid ones." I ain't nobody you want to call stupid. Ignorant of many things, but not stupid. On the other hand, Sophie sent along something from Molly Ivins. "Wherever souls go, I hope hers is just having a high old time. I miss her. I miss her in the same category of missing Hunter S. Thompson. I do. It is a, from where I sit, it is less of a world that Molly Ivins ain't in." But she was tasked some time back, Molly Ivins was, with reading and writing about Camille Paglia. Molly Ivins writes, "Paglia contends that feminism is responsible for the aerobics craze and concern over thin thighs. Speaking as a beer-drinking feminist whose idea of watching her diet is to choose either the baked potato with sour cream or with butter, but not with both, I find this loony beyond all hope, and I am the cosmos too, says Ms. Ivins. But this is the nut of it. What we have here, fellow citizens, is a crassly egocentric raving twit, the Norman Podoritz of our gender. That this woman is actually taken seriously as a thinker in New York intellectual circles is a clear sign of decadence, decay, and hopeless pinheadedness. Has no one in the nation's intellectual capital the background and ability to see through a web of categorical assertions? One fashionable line of response to Pallia is to claim that even though she may be fundamentally off base, she has, quote, flashes of brilliance, unquote. If so, I miss them in her oceans of swill. She closes, Molly Ivins does, by saying, there is one area in which I think Pallia and I would agree that politically correct feminism has produced a noticeable inequity. Nowadays, when a woman behaves in a hysterical and disagreeable fashion, we say, poor dear, it's probably PMS. Whereas if a man behaves in a hysterical and disagreeable fashion, we say, what an asshole. Let me leap to correct this unfairness by saying of Pallia, sheesh, what an asshole. Well, okay, that's all cleared up for me now. Now I understand all this, and she gets to rant at Salon? Okay, now I understand so much more about the gender dysphoric line about liberal hosts primly stirring their non-caffeine green tea. Piss off, Camille. Okay, that's just me. I'm just saying. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, my friend. I'm going to go a bit off topic from what you...
You go anywhere you want, brother.
Okay, my friend. Just when you think the Fox Empire, Rupert Murdoch's empire can go as low as they can, they will go one step lower.
Every time you think you've gotten all the way through all the sub-basements, you find one more trap door, yep.
Oh, yeah. And guess where they're going through?
Do tell.
The Fox Movie Network.
I thought we already had the Fox Channel. I mean, this is something different.
They have Movie Channel that shows Fox films, you know, like 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
Rupert Murdoch owns it.
Yeah.
Every week, they've been showing at least 3 or 4 times a week the Planet of the Apes franchise.
Really now?
Yes.
And why would they do that?
I guess, come on.
Dear Jesus.
Yeah. You know, and I'm a huge Planet of the Apes fan. I love Planet of the Apes. But all you need to do is feed this to some right-wing a-hole.
Yeah, it is not manipulation of the surface of the culture. It is manipulation of the subcurrents.
Yeah, and you know, I just thought about it because I noticed ever since November, the first Tuesday of November, Planet of the Apes. I've seen a Planet of the Apes movie every 2 weeks, and you know, I'm like, wow, this is my childhood and all that. And over this past weekend, I just put 2 and 2 together, and I'm like, what the F is going on?
See, I loved the remake of Planet of the Apes.
I didn't care for that much.
It was wildly different, but I loved it if for no other reason than the director had the highly ironic sense of casting an aging Charlton Heston as one of the apes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one thing about Charlton Heston, he's a William Shatner of the big screen.
Yeah, okay.
I love his body of work. He wasn't that brilliant of an actor, but I love the movies that he was in.
You better watch your ass, mister, or some hotshot Jap's going to flame your ass. Yeah,
and,
Midway.
You know, And Jim Carrey does it, one of the best Charlton Heston impersonations ever. But I totally disagree with his politics, especially in the last 20 years of his life. But
well, the funny thing was, way back when he was making Soylent Green, and again, this is another irony with regard to the casting of Charlton Heston in the remake of Planet of the Apes. In Soylent Green, the last scene that Edward G. Robinson would ever be in, mm-hmm. in his long and illustrious film career, was his deathbed scene in Soylent Green.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it comes full circle, and the last scene that Charlton Heston would ever be in a film, was his deathbed scene in the remake of Planet of the Apes.
I thought it was Fahrenheit 9, Bowling for Columbine.
No, but I'm talking about a film role, not a documentary.
Okay. You know, it's...
But there is some irony in that. But back when he was making Soylent Green, and see, I don't know who gets to or how this sort of the transmogrification happens, Kevin, but, you know, Reagan was a liberal once.
Oh, yeah, well, the thing is...
And so, too, was Charlton Heston at the time that he was making Soylent Green.
Well, the thing is, okay, and I mentioned this in my book, okay, which is being edited in order to get published.
Right.
Not to bite your show for advertising.
No, please do.
But I mentioned Charlton Heston as typical work, you know, white male in America where, yeah, they wanted the New Deal and all that, but they wanted to keep it amongst white males only. You know, when it started going straight white males only, you know, Charlton Heston is your stereotypical northern Midwestern white guy where he wanted union representation and all the New Deal programs as long as it benefited him, but when it came down to everybody else besides his type, no. Absolutely not.
Well, you know, going back to Soylent Green, you know, that was the 1970s, and it made that typical 1970s mistake of assuming that somewhere in a far distant future, all fashion sense would utterly disappear from human consciousness, and we would all be, I guess, furniture design and architecture would all end in about 1968. So that there were all those stupid bubble chairs and vinyl and polyester and crap like that. But the underlying premise, that of mass hunger, mass overpopulation, massive violence, all of that, it didn't, you know, from the 70s to now, it didn't take a whole generation for that to become true. Because while Soylent Green is set in New York City, it is a reality today in Mumbai, Bombay, Calcutta, all over China. It is a reality in some American cities. I don't live in a bubble. It's a reality, you know, in parts of New York.
Believe it or not, I think New York is very sheltered from a lot of things.
Really?
I really think the future of most of America is going to be Mad Max.
Could be. Mad Max is sort of the rural past rural side of what Soylent suburban. Green is in a city.
No, suburban.
Exurban, even.
Yeah. That's going to be really. Because they've been showing a lot of the Road Warrior recently here.
Yeah, I noticed. I was walking through the living room the other day and I noticed one of the Mad Max movies was on.
Yeah, and I think because living in Florida and in North Central Florida, where I used to live in the Orlando area, there are about 5 or 6 biker gangs out there. And I tell you, and they're really active and they're very wealthy and they're very hardcore bikers. It's a huge biker scene out there. And all I can think of is the Road Warrior.
Well, it does it. hopefully, you know, one of the upsides, I saw an announcement from the Obama administration earlier today, Kevin, stating that something rare is happening, that of the transportation-based stimulus projects that have already been funded, that they have, A, been funded, B, they are ahead of schedule, and C, they are under budget. Tell me a Republican that can pull that off.
Oh, of course.
So, you know, maybe we're not quite to Apocalypticville yet.
Yeah, but we're getting there.
But there are seeds, because the culture itself, by virtue of the fact that we've artificially propped up the carrying capacity of the planet by foisting, by externalizing consumption off on a substantial portion of the people of this earth who live horrific lives, lives just the same. We've propped that all up on a very fragile underpinning that the collapse of which occupies a number of substantial thinkers' minds. Any given city in the United States, you know this full well, being a New Yorker. Any given city in this country and in most parts of the world, they are all one simple disaster away from collapse, from absolute chaos.
Yeah, and I told that, and I'm writing off it about that too, because I go deeper into the fall of the Roman Empire. You know, how the Huns, the Vikings, and the Celts, and the Germans all, because the Romans all cheated them out of money at the same time.
Well, you know, I don't know if you've seen this. Very true, Kevin, very true. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but the right wing is doing what the right wing always does. The morning started with that creepy dude with the porn mustache, John Bolton. Arguing that we need to invade Somalia now. And anybody who studies Roman history knows that the beginning of the end of the Republic lay in the massive plenary summary powers that were given to Pompey the Great, to clear out the pirate crisis in the eastern Mediterranean.
Of course.
And those pirates were a little different from the Somali pirates, from any pirates.
Okay.
It's all a matter of how the culture defines them. You know, for instance, during the so-called heyday of piracy in the New World, a great deal of pirates were not people who set out, what do you want to be? What do you want to be, little Johnny? I want to be a pirate. No. They were people who had been in somebody's royal naval service, be it Britain's or France's or Spain's, and experienced the harsh injustices prevalent there, and basically went free agent.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a note in my book where I say, and it's a Norse, well, it comes from the English Book of Common Prayer, where you say, God, please protect us from the Norsemen. And I write a line saying, I plan on being one of those Norsemen. I'm not going to be the sheep.
No. But the question, you know, the question is whether you wind up with a choice.
No. I plan on being one of those Norsemen.
Well, you might look good with one of those bronze helmets with the cow horns on top.
Have you seen me in Facebook? there's a picture of me with a cow.
you haven't friended up with me on Facebook yet, I don't think.
Ask Guy James.
Okay, but you know, I'm there, Bob Kincaid on Facebook. Just click away.
Okay, I will. I will.
I'm a come one, come all, you know, kind of Facebook host.
Yeah. But ask Guy James, but I plan on being one of those Norsemen. Grant is a Norman name.
True, true.
Yeah. And even though I am mostly Celt, but Grant is Norman name.
Well, you know, my Agnes comes from Norman stock and indirectly, therefore, by way of the Vikings. It explains a lot, Kevin. It explains a lot.
Oh, yes. Trust me. And half of the parish where I come from in Jamaica, and, well, my family comes from two parishes. They're Celt, mostly. They're Scots-Irish.
Right.
Yeah. Who married into black people, East Indian people, and so on and so forth.
It makes for a nice mix.
Of course.
Well, I look forward to reading. Excerpt me some of this stuff sometime.
I need to. I really need to. I will hook you up to online and I'll start reading you because, believe it or not, you're in the book. Believe it or not.
Oh, my God. Cool.
Yeah. Trust me. You are.
I'm almost afraid to ask, but.
Okay.
Kevin, take care, brother.
Okay, bro.
All right. Later. Bye now. Our buddy Kevin calling from Brooklyn. Where did this show go? We got about 30 minutes left in the program. 25. If you got something to say, say it, by all means. A couple of things to go to before we get out of here. I promised that I would get to it and not forget. Our buddy David in Tennessee sent me a note earlier. He said an hour, and this was about 5 hours ago. An hour or so ago, I caught a few minutes from El Rushbo, as Susan noted, he took one for the team. As I understood the gas bag, he said, "Now, my friends, this isn't being reported by the drive-bys, but it is my thought that Obama ordered the captain to surrender himself. That move could only have come from Obama. He did so that he, Obama, could order this rescue thing and look presidential." See, I see something like this, and of course, that's how the phlegm ball behaves. David notes, "Really? So with nothing more to go on than I think, he says that? Were I to listen to the other echo chamber types, I'd hear, 'It has been reported by Rush that...'" Oh, dear. Yeah. So, taking it for gospel, I ran off to check out Flush Flimball and his take on the Somali pirates. What do I get? Well, try this one on for size.
By the way, I did, and I have been paying some attention to what these pirates, the Merchant Marine organizers, have been saying. You know, these people are mad. They're mad that three of them met with Davy Jones now.
Davy Jones. Landlubber.
And when I listen to these pirates, these Somali Merchant Marine organizers... You know, these pirates, they used to know they were bad people. Have you ever watched Pirates of the Caribbean with Johnny Depp?
Come on, Bob. There's only 28 minutes left in the program. Don't put your foot through the monitor. This guy just equated the Somali pirates with a Disney movie. Now, you know, that's the kind of wit and brains. Oh, where did she go? There it is. Yeah. What was Camille Paglia saying earlier? The conservative hosts love to rant and stomp and bring down the house. They're doing breakneck vaudeville. You know, while I'm over here primly stirring my non-caffeine green tea. By the way, I did check into Breakneck Vaudeville. And I was told, I got, you know, never heard the phrase before. Again, this is from David in Tennessee, who has reason to know the genre. Never heard the phrase before. Certainly there was slapstick in ample amounts, but Breakneck Vaudeville? No. Nor would a participant in the art form ever say breakneck as related to pacing. They would have no more offered up breakneck any more than a legitimate actor say the one word name of the Scottish play. Bingo. So anyway, Flimball, of course. What was her complaint about liberal talkers? They like to snap and snip and chortle snidely, but they're weighed down by a complacent superiority complex. And what is Flimball referring to the Somali pirates as? The merchant marine organizers? A, poking fun at America's merchant marine. You know, this dirty little bastard has the gall to poke fun at the people who were aboard the Maersk Alabama, whose ship, I am told, was laden with supplies for a starving corner of Africa? Merchant marine. The Merchant Marine Academy is an honorable, honorable place to do one's studies. But he's poking fun at them. Merchant Marine organizers. And he gets a twofer out of it. One, he pokes fun at the Merchant Marine. You know, Flush, you landlubber. Not that I'm not one, but I have some respect for people who go down to the sea in ships. Were you down in the engine room of the Maersk Alabama? I dare say your lardy ass wouldn't last 5 minutes. I know from talking to my father, who worked below the waterline for 3 years of his life in the South Pacific, that it is a hot place. It is a hard place. It is a sweaty place. It is a brutal place. It is a dangerous place, Flush. Far too dangerous for one soft soul such as you. One wonders who actually is the one, are the ones who are primly stirring their green damn tea.
I mean, these are mean, rotten people. I mean, these, like, Blue Beard, Red Beard, Black Beard, Captain Hook. These were terrorists. These were...
Of the ones he just named, Blue Beard, Red Beard, Black Beard, Captain Hook, how many of those were real? Just ask it. They weren't terrorists, you dumbass. Some of them were characters out of fiction.
Bad, bad guys. They didn't care what they smelled like, looked like, thought. They did nothing. They took their bounty and they ran around. They terrorized. When the pirate ship was pulling into port, the women and children fled.
Well, you know, when the Royal Navy pulled into port, the women and children fled too, Rush. You goddamned historical ignoramus. When the French Navy pulled into port, the women and children fled. When the Spanish Navy pulled into port, the women and children fled. It has much more to do with navies and men confined to ships with nothing but other men for months on end than it does with what one's particular variety is. Jesus, the level of ignorance and how within that pop universe populated, according to Camille Paglia, by the feisty, super-organized homeschooling moms, the gruffly, stoical, transcontinental truckers, and the fiercely independent and self-reliant small business owners outraged by Washington's tilt toward bailing out corrupt, top-heavy corporations, where, how many of them, have the intellectual acuity to understand that this man doesn't know from Shinola what he's talking about with Somali pirates? But he ain't done.
Now, these pirates are kind of disappointing me. The Somali Merchant Marine organizers actually sound like they're entitled. Their feelings are hurt. They think they're entitled to these ransoms that are being paid, and I get the impression listening to them they expect to be told good job, pirate, good job. They're acting offended as hell here that our captain was rescued by our president, ordered by the Navy SEALs to rescue it.
Even that business rescued by our president. That's snide. What's the phrase again? Yeah. Snap and snip and chortle snidely. That's snide. Because Rush has argued previously that the media are being unfair because they're claiming that Obama personally gave the order when to shoot. He's lying, of course. No such thing happened. But let's finish.
And that they didn't get the ransom? As though they're entitled to it. These people have an entitlement mentality. I could have sworn they were originally Americans who maybe fled. Maybe they were illegal immigrants.
Maybe they were illegal immigrants.
Why do you hate America, Rush? Why did you just assert
that the Somali pirates are Americans who've left the country? Why'd you do that, Rush?
Or something, you got here, coming to the entitlement mentality, didn't like it, fled the scene because Republicans drove them out of the country in the last election. So they fled over to Somalia and they started pirating things. Because they have the attitude of entitlement, just like a lot of American citizens do. I mean, we got...
You're damn right, Rush. I've got an attitude of entitlement, you son of a bitch. I am entitled, and not so much me, but my children and grandchildren are entitled to breathe clean air and not the poisonous detritus and garbage that your corporate masters pump into the skies. That my kids and grandkids have a right to drink clean water, not the poisonous goo that your supporters and your masters pump into the water. You're damn right I've got a sense of entitlement.
You know, they call them what they want to call themselves. We've got Somali pirates. We've got the Beltway pirates. Beltway pirates are led by Pelosi and Reid. The Beltway pirates, think 2 million? That's Trump change. The Beltway pirates are demanding a $10 trillion ransom, not just from us, but from our kids and our grandkids and their grandkids.
Why wasn't George Bush on that list of pirates, Rush? Because he ransomed my children's future long before Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid ever had any power. He ransomed my children's future with an off-the-books war. He ransomed my children and grandchildren's future with tax cuts that did not benefit them. Why isn't George W. Bush, why isn't Dick Cheney, why isn't Condoleezza Rice, why isn't Douglas Feith, why isn't John Yoo, why aren't any of these freaks on your damn list? And his ability to spit on Captain Phillips is absolutely stunning. Utterly, it's kind of like what Kevin said. Every time I think they've gone as low as they can go, they go lower. And nobody is immune from being used by this $40 million piece of human excrement to advance his twisted, fascistic, miserable agenda.
Let me tell you what bothers me about this. Since I have been open in my praise, since I have agreed with Jonah Gold.
Goldberg,
that we need to bite the bullet, praise President Obama when he does the right thing. What really...
Cough switch! They're $40! Cough switch! Nobody wants to hear your phlegm flush!
I mean, here's a little secret. I guess maybe I'm just shy. Maybe when you get to $40 million a year, you think that people, you know, that there's value in your throat clearing as well as in your, you know, it's kind of like what we've said, you know, that there's music in the silences between the notes as well as on the notes themselves. Maybe what you just heard was $40 million phlegm. I don't know. But I am. I'm kind of bashful and shy. I'll be honest with you. I make some funky noises. When you talk for 3 hours, you're going to make some funky noises. But I do everything in my power to keep from subjecting you to them because I don't like it when I hear other people doing it. So I figure you don't want to hear me blasting out a lung oyster or a sinus oyster or something like that. You don't want to hear it. It's pollen season, by the way. It's particularly bad right now. But not flush. Professional broadcasting is out the window when you get to the level of flush. Phlegm ball.
Bothers me with the way this brilliant rescue performed by the Navy SEALs. It really bothers me with the way this is being reported. I love that captain. I love the Navy SEALs. I love the U.S. military.
Yeah, tell us about it.
This is a spectacular success, and the timing on Easter Sunday could not have been better. It was a great day yesterday. This was an event that everybody was very proud of. That being said, I have a low-grade depression that underlies all this as I expose myself to this puking reporting by the drive-by media. Politico, New York Times, Washington Post have chosen the headline, Obama Saves Day, Obama, whatever, the giving Obama all the credit for this. And I know why Obama's being tied to this as if he is the lead and the man who made it all happen and not the heroes who were directly involved. This result, this wonderful result.
Who says he is besides you, Rush?
Honest to God, I couldn't do This little modest effort that I put forward every night, I could not do this if I was just making stuff up. My soul does not have, or whatever is back there, my conscience, my morality, does not permit me to just tell lies. Because everything you just heard was a complete creation inside the thin gray settlings that pass for a brain between the ears of Flush Flemball.
Folks, is going to result in raising Obama's approval ratings. That's what all of this is about.
Oh, so there was no approval rating raising going on when George W. Bush was standing on the rubble telling that phony made-up story about somebody giving him a badge or some such. No, there was nothing. No.
It'll result in a series of stories about bravery and military success with Obama as the key player. And these approval numbers that'll result from this reporting will be used as proof, or as Lanny Davis would say, poof, that Americans are totally on board for Obama's liberty-depleting domestic power grabs. While we're all celebrating the end of the day for the Somali pirates, we still have to deal with the Beltway pirates, who are looking to take $10 trillion from us over the next few generations. And that's going to be done with high approval.
What?
Ratings generated by this kind of puking reporting.
So on the one hand, we get actual phlegm noises, and then he follows it up. Does this dumbass understand that his show airs during lunch? I mean, I'm careful. I'm careful about what I say because I know that people are having dinner all over the country while I'm talking. And yet you get this for $40 million a
year. Of course we'll have socialized medicine. Look at Obama's approval numbers. Of course we'll have a card check and cap and trade down the road. Look at Obama's approval. You haven't seen his approval ratings? The American...
You moron! Do you even understand that there are three branches of government? Jesus! He's elevated Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, to maximum dictator for life who simply sweeps his pen across a piece of paper and magically makes legislation appear. Ain't gonna be no card check bill. Because we can't even get Democrats to support it. They ain't gonna be no universal health care, socialized medicine. Because we can't even get Democrats to support it. Not that any of his knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing faithful even understand that.
People want everything they can get from this guy. If critical thinking were in play...
You would not be on the air, but I digress.
I don't care. They can report that Obama took out all three criminals on his own. They can say whatever they want, but this incredible demonstration of bravery and skill by the military is going to be used to advance a domestic agenda, including the gutting of the military. While all the military is being praised to heaven here, guess what's happening in Washington? The military budget is being cut.
Dirty, rotten, filthy liar. If any of you, sometimes TV's handy. Because if any of you saw that graphic that Jon Stewart ran the other night, you might know that what the Republicans are describing as the gutting of the military budget is actually a substantial increase in the Pentagon budget. Lord knows, I wish we could do something by the way of cutting the Pentagon budget. But we can't and we won't. The budget is being increased. What has been cut are really stupid, wasteful weapons programs like the F-22 Raptor. But in turn, that means there's going to be more F-15s, F-A-18s, F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, stuff like that built. But he sits there and says the budget's being cut. And Repiglick and sitting there, yeah, sure is, because blah, 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 hates America. What?
These heroes are being and will be used to advance a domestic agenda of hard leftism. Returning Captain Phillips Liberty will be used to take away portions of ours.
Wow. It must have taken him hours with his little crayon to come up with that line. Returning Captain Phillips Liberty will take away portions of ours. Yeah, because you know what? America's going to be less free if it could go to the damn doctor when it was sick. America would be less free. Less free if working people could simply declare whether they wish to be in a union and thereby form a union. Yeah, that'd be less free, all right. Sweet Jesus. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Alan.
How you doing?
What's going on?
I finally got to see the Vietnam Memorial, and it's really simple and really moving to see all those names on that wall. And as you go down and you could see yourself in that wall, it makes you feel like you're a part of this country and you're a part of what happens in this country. And And when there's a war, you're a part of that. And it's such an eerie feeling, you know. And I would love to see Rush Limbaugh walk down that wall and look at those names and see who took his place, who died in his place, because he had a sore on his rear end.
Here, here.
He's such a disgrace. And also, I visited the place you went to, the WWF.
Yeah, World Wildlife Fund, not the World Wrestling Fund. Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, WWF, World Wildlife Fund. Yeah, I had a good time there. I went to the Lincoln Memorial also and listened to an opera singer sing. And it was in commemoration of a woman who sang there for FDR's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, because she couldn't sing in the White House because of the discrimination. She was a black woman. Had a good time.
Oh, that must have been moving.
Yeah.
But your observation about Flush Flimball and the names on that wall are so profound and so terribly, terribly true. You'd like to see Flush Flimball do it, Newt Gingrich. You'd like to see George Bush and Dick Cheney stand there and have to look at those names because they all dodged out and let someone else die in their place.
That's right. Oh, yeah. That wall was so, it's so moving, you know. It's such an eerie feeling to see that whole line of just nothing but names. How many names are on that wall? Do you have any idea?
Lord, 55,000?
Oh, man. All for a war could have been avoided. Same thing with this war. Are they going to make a memorial for this war?
If it does, it should be shaped like an oil pipeline.
Yeah.
Or a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's good. Where are you now? Are you still in D.C.?
Yeah, I'm down here in Manassas, Virginia. I stayed for a good while in Phoenix, Arizona. That was a lovely place.
I'm told it is. Well, if you're going to be around Manassas for very long, see the battlefield.
Yeah, I've seen it before, but I guess you can't see all of it. We're seeing again, too. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, we will talk soon. I'm sorry I ran short on time. I was running my mouth there and didn't get to you till late.
Oh.
I apologize.
Oh, that was really moving there. That Rush Limbaugh, I think he should be on his way out. People in this country ought to be waking up.
Well, they might if they had a chance to hear anything else, but they don't.
I know. That's the problem right there. That's where internet should kick in, and then try to keep.
Well, slowly we are. We just, you know, those of us on the horn, you know, Guy, myself, John, Mark, the weekend crew, Rick, Billy, and all the people behind the scenes who make all this go, we're hanging in there. We're struggling to stay afloat, and it is a struggle every day.
And you need money too.
Well, that, you know, it would be, it's surprising how much that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. No doubt about it.
There.
All right, you take care, Alan.
Right.
Bye now. Thanks. Travel safe.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. That observation about the wall that you see yourself in it. I don't know that I've ever seen heard that said before. But how profound that is. So thanks for getting this week off to such a Jim Dandy start. I hope you'll be here tomorrow evening as well. No kidding. The Horn needs your support. There's a PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is there as well. Any way you can help is much appreciated. The months are mighty lean. And it makes it frustrating to try to do things to keep things going, like get the right equipment in and so forth. So thank you to those of you who do help. And thanks to those of you who choose to help. And thanks to those of you who can't but wish you could. And thanks to those of you who share your time however you share it, whether it be live on the 24/7 stream or listening via podcast. Thank you. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. I received word during the show that the world's most dangerous but somehow lovable DJ, Larry, is doing better. And I'm so glad to hear it. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, chief musician, web designer, webmaster, Renaissance guy down under. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, trying to pull together the stuff to get a new machine in to do things that are vital to us getting out what we do here. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Their struggle, their fight, their actions, their commitments are constant and unending. And it is for everyone, all of us, for we are indeed all downstream. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right, let's get a brand new, fresh, shiny week started. What do you say? Shall we? About a minute and a half past the hour, this Monday evening edition of Head On is happening. I'm Bob. And I'm sure somebody will have something else, nothing particularly earth-shattering going down today as far as I can see. Phil Spector was convicted of second-degree murder. Look, you take that hair in front of a jury, it's good for stream littering by itself. It just is. But, there's some other things... other things to talk about. Sports fans out there, especially those of a certain age, by a certain age, I mean my age and older, you cherish a really, really good sports broadcaster.
and being a broadcaster at all, folks like Red Barber, Harry Carey, and a number of others, too many to mention, redefined for generations what communication meant. And we lost another giant today. Phillies broadcaster Harry Callis passed away, 73 years old. But instead of some sort of situation where the news story would say, he died after a long illness surrounded by his family. No, Harry Callis lived to see his beloved Phils take the World Series last year. He threw out the first pitch before the Phils faced the Braves on April the 8th. And he was at work today.